up is the news.
Yemenis rally in the northern city of Sada to condemn the UN for turning a blind eye to the massacre of Yemeni children by Saudi Arabia. Iran rejects a statement by the U.S. and France about the JCPOA, saying that it is up to Washington to make the decision on reviving the deal. And the World Health Organization says the shortage of coronavirus vaccines in low-income countries, especially in Africa, is a global failure. PM in Iran's capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Yemenis have staged a demonstration in the province of Sada to condemn the UN for its inaction to the violation of their rights, including those of children. The protesters also expressed their anger towards the recent UN decisions to include Yemen's Ansarullah movement in its blacklist of parties violating children's rights. The resistance movement itself had earlier denounced the measure by calling it disgraceful, unjust, and far from realities. It accused the world body of turning a blind eye to the massacre of Yemeni children by Saudi Arabia over the past years. Since Riyadh launched its devastating military campaign against Yemen in 2015, thousands of children have been killed or displaced. Yemeni officials say that more than 2.6 million Yemeni children also suffer from malnutrition, and hundreds of them are in urgent need of medical treatment abroad. Political commentator John Stuffling says that the UN acts as an organ of the U.S.'s propaganda machine when it comes to issuing official declarations.
Saudi orchestrated and led assault on Yemen, of course, that had British and American assistance from the beginning. That assault did not go as planned. It didn't go as planned from day one. And it has been an embarrassment for bin Salman. The Saudi fighters were inept. They were targeting hospitals, water purification plants, schools, etc. And so the humanitarian catastrophe became just enormous, almost unimaginable. And civilians were targeted, and thousands of children have been killed. Now, the UN never speaks in one voice, really, anyway, and that should be borne in mind. But they do a lot of hand-wringing and whatnot. But when it comes to official declarations, they are never going to cross the U.S. The U.N., at the end of the day, is an organ of the U.S. propaganda machine, and it has no real teeth to any of the resolutions it passes.
As well as Secretary General Syed Hassan Nasrallah has denounced the U.S. government's move to seize dozens of media websites. He says that the main reason behind the decision is doubtless support for the Palestinian cause. Mariam Saleh has more from Beirut.
Hezbollah Secretary General Syed Hassan Nasrallah began his televised speech by denouncing the U.S. administration's decision to seize and block dozens of website domains connected to Iranian and regional media outlets.
It's not coincidental that these websites which were seized are media outlets that had a major role in supporting the Palestinians in the Sword of Al-Quds battle. They all had a clear position from the Zionist enemy and the American hegemony over the region. These outlets are critical of sedition and terrorism, specifically Takfiri terrorism. This gives us and the free people of the world another piece of evidence against the false claims of the U.S. administration, which claims to defend freedom of speech and freedom of opinion.
Syed Nasrallah also criticized U.S. statements that attempt to incite the Lebanese army against the resistance. Syed Nasrallah noted that U.S. officials have tried to justify their humble support to the Lebanese army by stressing that this assistance is aimed at giving the army leverage to confront Hezbollah. This, Syed Nasrallah says, will not happen since the National Army is the main guarantor for peace in the country. On another note, the resistance leader explained how Hezbollah has been exerting an effort to mediate talks for the formation of the cabinet.
All efforts in the country must come together to form a government and to pull the country out of this dilemma. Since Prime Minister-designate Saad Hariri was named by most members of parliament, we have been working on a quick formation of the cabinet. We have been supportive of an initiative from Speaker Barry, and we will work on finding resolutions to the last few disagreements in the talks.
Experts believe Saeed Nasrallah's words and sufferings of the people lining up at gas stations and pharmacies should be an incentive for the officials to find solutions.
Saeed Nasrallah said there is no magical solution, and he stressed that the crisis should be disintegrated and resolved one by one until the government is reestablished. If we want to go back to the state where the government collects taxes and the citizens practice their rights and responsibilities in paying taxes, where there are investments in the country again and we create more job opportunities, all of these issues need political stability. And political stability will be the only first step to genuinely solve the many crises in the country.
Saeed Nasrallah has stressed that Hezbollah has accomplished all the administrative and logistic preparations for importing gasoline and fuel from Iran to Lebanon in case the state fails to cover the fuel shortage. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
It's time now for the news review of this bulletin. Tehran says it will return to compliance with the 2015 nuclear deal only after the U.S. removes its sanctions on Iran in a verifiable manner. The Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman said that Iran has unilaterally held the agreement alive since the U.S. left the agreements and the European sides to the deal could not live up to their commitments. Saeed Khatibzadeh said it is the U.S., not Iran, which must make the decision on returning to the deal by removing its illegal sanctions. The remarks come after the U.S. and France said it was up to Iran to take the final difficult decisions to revive the deal. Khatibzadeh said Washington's complete non-compliance with the JCPOA has, in effect, impeded the implementation of the deal. Heinz Gardner is a political scientist at International Institute for Peace, joining us from Vienna. We also have Mustafa Hoshesh, who's a journalist and political commentator, who joins us. Heinz, let me first start with you. If you want to take the recent statements by the U.S. and France, saying that it's up to Iran to come back to the deal. First of all, what do you see in those statements? Because there's been so many stances back and forth between Iran and the world powers on this nuclear deal that's been in negotiations for quite some time now. What is your initial reaction to this?
My initial reaction is that now is not the time to go back to this poker game. What we know from the beginning of the negotiations 2 months ago. So talks have gone very far since then already. Next week there will be the seventh round. Maybe there will be results next week already a little bit later. So each side by now should be satisfied what they agreed. The U.S. Promised to lift about 1,000 to 1,500 sanctions which have an economic impact. That should be sufficient to give the Iranian economy a good boost. And Iran, of course, promised and committed itself to remove the so-called remedy measures, and that everything will be inspected, verified by the IAEA. So it is important that they give up a face-saving game, and that the results will be implemented. The results of the negotiations so far have to be implemented in a very pragmatic way. So we should not spoil what has been achieved in the negotiations right now.
Mustafa Hoshesh, let me start with you with some of the stances that Robert Malley has taken, and tell us what you think about his position and the weight that it carries. The most recent one that I see here of significance is that the U.S. Will not be lifting all of the Trump-imposed sanctions on Iran.
Hello. Well, you know, the United States is just thinking of its containment strategy. They are not at a negotiating table for resolving the conflict. What they want is containing Iran's power, and the JCPOA is part one of multiple agreements to this end. That's why they try hard to keep the sanctions that happened to be the only weapon of choice for the United States to lay pressure on Iran as intact as possible. Therefore, they are adamant to do doing the wrong, the right thing. What we are looking for is not sanctions inclusions. There are over 1,500 sanctions inclusions on Iranian entities, sectors, oil, gas, petrochemical industries, or the insurance companies, shipping sector, individuals, and institutions. What we are looking for and what we want is, number one, removal of sanctions laws. There are no more than a handful number of sanctions laws, like ISA, like CAFSA, and the like, and they should remove them first. Then they need to end the sanctions, the over 1,500 sanctions inclusions, and they are adamant to doing that. They just say that they are going to suspend ISA, and they would not deal with the rest of the laws, first of all. Secondly, they say that they are going just to suspend or remove around 200, 1,200, or 1,300 sanctions inclusions. But these are the details. As a matter of fact, what matters here is that the United States is not willing to, revive the 2015 nuclear deal. What they want is an updated version of the deal. As a matter of fact, this would include less gives and more takes for the United States. They intend Iran to agree even to more under the JCPOA that they like, but to give more and more concessions. Like when Donald Trump last summer, around October or September, as a matter of fact, he withdrew from Resolution 2231. And he disrespected the JCPOA and the resolution that removed the ban on Iran's arms trade forever by removing the six UN resolutions against Iran forever. But when Biden returned to that resolution, 2231, he declared that he respects the resolution and its contents, but still he says that there is a ban on Iran's arms trade. That means, over the paper, he agrees to the JCPOA, but in action, he wants to deplete the content of the JCPOA and ratify and revive a new version of the JCPOA, unfortunately, including the very fact that paragraph 25 says the United States, EU, the UN are not allowed to remove the sanctions, the nuclear-related sanctions, and replace them with new version of sanctions similar to them, but under different pretexts like terrorism, missile industry, and so on and so forth. That's exactly what they are doing. They want to deplete paragraph 25. I believe the Americans are not really thinking of reviving the deal or for a conflict resolution. They just mean to revive it in the way they like for containing Iran. But one thing, they don't care and they are not paying attention, really. And that's it, that they have a few weeks ahead. Mm-hmm. After President Raisi comes to office, the deal, if there will be a deal, then that deal would not be any better. It would be probably much more difficult for the United States under Raisi compared to what they can get under Rouhani.
Okay, Heinz Gartner, do you agree with that?
I do think each agreement has to be a compromise. Neither side can get everything it wants. And Iran in the past has, during the negotiations, has already demonstrated some flexibility because it has said it has priorities like oil, finance, shipping, car industry, insurance. So this other sanctions should be lifted first. So that can be done in packages. I do think that the United States want to come back to the JCPOA. The United States is concerned that Iran comes near the developing of a nuclear weapon, and it is concerned that the IAEA will not have access anymore. So that's why it is important that the technical agreement now between Iran and the IAEA will be extended. It expired, as you probably know, in June 24. It will be extended until the new measures will be implemented, the new old verification measures by the IEA, because a blind IEA can be very, very dangerous, because then Israel might cry foul and say, you see, the Iranians want to have the nuclear weapon. So the IEA has to be in Iran in order to get a proper implemented agreement. So there is no time now for playing games now. Implement, agree, and implement what has been achieved.
Okay, thank you very much for that. Heinz Gardner, political scientist at the International Institute for Peace. Mustafa Hoshchesh, a pleasure, journalist and political commentator. With that, we come to an end for this edition of the Newsroom. The World Health Organization has criticized the shortage of coronavirus vaccines in the poor countries, calling it a global failure.
The world, as international community, other world is failing. As global community, we are failing. The problem is vaccine supply. And even now, it's not the absorptive or the delivery problem that's a problem. There is no vaccine.
The WHO chief said the vaccination situation in many low-income countries, especially in Africa, is worrisome. He said that while less than 2% of the population is vaccinated in these countries, the infections are surging by 50% on a weekly basis. He also raised concern about the Delta variant that first emerged in India and its rapid spread among unvaccinated populations. He said the only way to prevent the emergence of these new variants is to thwart further transmission of the virus. He warned that otherwise, new variants will continue to emerge. With that, we come to an end for this edition of World News. That's bye-bye for now.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Enemies of Iran have always opposed elections in the Islamic Republic. This is part of a speech delivered on May 27, 2021 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the members of the 11th Parliament. The speech was delivered via video conference with the participation of the Speaker of the Parliament and other members.
Since the formation of this Parliament, some people have set themselves the task of portraying a negative picture of the parliament. These people have made certain statements and they continue to do so. They say certain things in various media, which everyone has access to, statements that do not smell of sympathy. Sometimes one criticizes another person in order to correct and improve that person's behavior, and sometimes they do it on the basis of emotions or personal viewpoints, devoid of any sense of sympathy. Therefore, one feels that there is no pure intention in such hostile moves. One can easily witness this. I want to tell you that you should take no heed of them, and you should not be concerned about them. You should just do your job and pursue good plans. The people, the intellectual society, and youth perfectly understand who is doing what. In genuine propaganda reveals its true colors sooner or later, and its untruthfulness becomes evident. However, the word of advice that I have for you is that you should take care not to help the cause of the opponents with your actions and words. This is a piece of advice which I wish to stress. One's words and actions in the 11th Parliament should not lead to the strengthening of the words and positions of this Parliament's opponents. Now, I wish to offer some words of advice on the basis of these statements. One important piece of advice is that you should preserve the good qualities you have. You are revolutionary, diligent, energetic, and serious. You should preserve these qualities until the end of your term. One should say that you should preserve them until the end of your lives, but at least you should have them with you until the end of your term. There used to be many people who had these characteristics in the beginning. They were revolutionaries, they were energetic, and they would speak and work in an enthusiastic manner, but they could not resist temptations in the course of time. The temptation of money, position, fame, and various ambitions. They could not resist, and their path grew, and their behavior changed.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah. Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
Africa Today.
Despite an estimated 2,000 languages being spoken across Africa, for many to succeed in the continent, they have no option but to learn English or French, the languages of the countries which colonize most of Africa. Now, experts are warning that this trend might lead to the extinction of indigenous languages. Renowned African writer Ngugi Wa Thiong'o says abandoning one's indigenous language is tantamount to enslavement. Let's take a listen.
There's a difference between adding another language to what you already have, which I call empowerment, and what I call, you know, the other, where you add many languages. You remove your own language completely, and then you acquire other languages, which they call enslavement. Yeah.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a warm welcome to this edition of Africa Today, which is focusing on the dangers that African languages are facing amid rapid globalization, which has seen the dominance of English and French. Our experts will provide an incisive analysis and present possible solutions to this challenge facing African nations, which are fighting to preserve their identity. It will be great hearing from you, so keep in touch through our social media handles.
English, French imperil African languages. Africa has 55 countries that use a variety of languages, including some that are endangered due to several factors, especially the influence of Western culture. Every African language is a repository of history, culture, and values. So when a language dies, so too does history, culture, values, and the sense of identity. African language experts are waking up to the reality that a lack of school reading material in local languages is increasingly sounding the death knell for mother tongues.
With bilingual education, children are more active because they master the language. They are not afraid to speak to the teacher. They communicate better in a local language, a language they know well.
Experts and activists across Africa are now trying to restore the link between the people and their mother tongues. Now, for more analysis on this subject, we contacted Professor Kimani Njogu. He's a Kenyan linguist and a publisher who is also a member of the Kiswahili Cross-Border Language Commission at the African Academy of Languages, an organ of the African Union. Thank you very much, Professor.
You're welcome. Thank you very much for having me. Thank you.
We also have Mr. Africa Kiiza, a development anthropologist based in Kampala, Uganda. Thank you also for joining us today.
Most welcome. Thank you for having me.
Now, Professor Kimani Njogu, first tell us, why is it important to maintain indigenous languages in Africa?
Well, you see, languages are carriers of culture. They are also carriers of knowledge, and they are carriers of histories. And this is not particular to African languages or indigenous languages. This refers to virtually all languages of the world. Therefore, when we preserve and develop indigenous African languages, we are, in a sense, appreciating and recognizing their place as carriers of African history or the histories of the African people and their experiences, as well as their knowledge systems and their philosophies and their values and so forth and so on. So the development and the promotion of African languages is part of a whole system of appreciating knowledge production from the African continent.
Thank you for that, Professor Kimani Njogu.
Love for European languages in Africa comes from the colonial mentality that foreign languages are better than their local languages and are a guarantee for the future. Once young people go to higher education, they abandon their mother tongues, thinking they are archaic, and prefer to speak foreign languages such as French or English.
Now, Mr. Kiiza, how has over-reliance on European languages while abandoning local languages affected development in Africa?
We have lost on this freedom of determining our own development path as Africa because the current narrative and agenda of development is informed by the culture and language of the West. So it is important if we are to develop as Africa from our own pace, and often as Africa we have been saying we wish to have Africa solutions to African problems. We cannot have this narrative. We cannot achieve this narrative of having African solutions to African problems when we keep relying on a language which is not ours.
Now, globalization and social media are also driving Africans away from their mother tongues. Many people are also no longer feeling proud to speak their mother tongue, as English and French and other European languages have replaced local languages in homes and schools in many parts of Africa. Our Zimbabwean language expert here speaks on the importance of the preservation of indigenous languages. Let's listen.
It's good to share information, exchange ideas, but at the end of the day, who are we? We need to know our identity. We need to actually build on what we know, build on what makes us, Zimbabweans.
Professor Kimani Njogu, now how serious is the threat faced by African languages from European languages, especially English and French?
They are in danger, really, of this suppression and domination by European languages, notwithstanding the fact that they are the ones, that is African languages, they are the ones that are spoken by over 70% or 80%
of Africans across the continent. Therefore, the danger here is that the continued domination of indigenous languages or African languages by European languages undermines African histories, African philosophies, and the contribution of the continent to knowledge, global knowledge. And therefore, it's really a very serious issue here.
It's quite clear that European colonial languages have continued to dominate in education, commerce, the media, and interaction between African countries. While international languages are crucial for communication and academic transfer and engagement, the use of indigenous languages ensures that local populations are integrated in the development agenda. Is the use of English and French in most development documents in Africa discriminatory to those who do not understand or actually do not want to use these languages?
African countries are actually, currently we are negotiating the African Continental Free Trade Area, an agreement that is going to unite to bring about an open market, a common market of free movement of goods and services within Africa. But there is actually fighting amongst the Francophone-speaking Africa, and the French-speaking Africa, and the English-speaking Africa countries because of the fact that which language takes precedence.
Local languages in Africa, just like in many parts of the world, are the basis for cultural identity and local development. African languages that survived the colonial era are now facing the danger of extinction amid an onslaught by European languages. During a visit to Burkina Faso in 2018, French President Emmanuel Macron unveiled his strategy to promote his native language, aiming to make it the first language in Africa.
Now let's go back to Professor Kimani Njogu. Do you think the gradual disregard of indigenous languages in Africa is a deliberate move by imperial powers to wipe out the identity of African people?
Well, let me say this, that colonial project was always a project of domination and suppression of competing ideas. And therefore, under colonialism, the French deliberately suppressed African languages in their colonies, and the British did the same with regard to African languages, and the Portuguese did the same. Therefore, one could say that the colonial project was a project to deny the African people their identity and the base from which they could recollect their history. And even in situations where these languages were supported, they were not deliberately developed. And this has continued through the post-colonial period.
Now, speaking in 2019 during the International Day of the World's Indigenous Peoples, UN Deputy Secretary General Amina Mohammed spoke on the need to preserve, revitalize, and promote indigenous languages.
Almost half the world's estimated 6,700 languages are in danger of disappearing. Many of those belong to indigenous people. With every language that disappears, a world loses a wealth of traditional knowledge and cultural heritage. Education will have a pivotal role to play in ensuring that indigenous people can enjoy and preserve their culture and identity. Intercultural and multilingual education will be necessary to prevent the irreparable loss.
Now, Mr. Kiza, what are some of the urgent measures that need to be taken to ensure that future generations in Africa continue using local languages?
Yes, that's an interesting question. The first one and most critical is human capacity, human capital development. We need to invest in building the capacity of our human resource, of our development policymakers, of our negotiators, especially the young ones, of the development commentators, in ensuring that they speak our own languages. In investing resources in our own universities of higher learning, our own research institutions, to teach in African languages, to teach development from an African perspective, and reality is another issue which I think is critical if African countries are to nurture and to bring back the African languages with among the young generations.
Thank you very much, Mr. Africa Kiza, for your insight today. Now we shall take a short break, so don't go away.
English, French imperil African languages.
In 2019, linguistic history was made after students at the University of Cape Town in South Africa graduated from an indigenous language course with roots that date back more than 200,000 years. The Khoisan are known to be one of the earliest inhabitants of Southern Africa, but their language was largely lost during the colonial period. A student who studied the language in university speaks on her accomplishment.
The course itself was an amazing journey to go on to learn this language that was used by my ancestors, by everyone's ancestors. Definitely made a change in my life, and it makes a change in everyone's life, just even to know a few words out of it.
Now, Professor Kimani Njogu, what sort of intervention is needed to uplift the indigenous languages in Africa?
Now, I think the first place for immediate intervention is to look at the educational system and to ask the question, how can we build a continuity, a continuum between what the child experiences within the community in terms of language and what the child experiences within the educational system? How can we build a continuity in the two experiences?
Renowned African novelist from Kenya, Professor Ngugi wa Thiong'o, didn't deliver his acceptance speech in English when last year he was honored as the 31st recipient of the Catalonia International Prize for his daring and distinguished literary work and defense of African languages. He has been writing in his native Kikuyu language since the 80s after abandoning English. Ngugi wrote a book titled Decolonizing the Mind, The Politics of Language in African Literature. He explains here on how he made the revolutionary decision to write in his mother tongue.
That I would no longer write my fiction or poetry in English anymore. I was going to write in an African language, and I was going to write in the only language then I knew quite well, which was Kikuyu. I had to do this. I had to find a way of connecting myself to myself can only know themselves via England, in this case, or via European languages, or via Europe.
In July 2004, Kiswahili was declared the official language of the 55-member African Union, with the then chairperson Joachim Chissano delivering his entire speech during the AU summit in the language. Now, Professor Kimani Njogu, you earlier talked there about the Swahili or Kiswahili language. As we know, the African Union has adopted Swahili language as one of its official languages. Do you think this language can be used as the lingua franca in Africa?
Absolutely. I think that, first of all, we must commend the African Union for taking the position that Swahili or Kiswahili be adopted as one of its official languages, and therefore used at the African Union meetings, at the Pan-African Parliament, and other, fora across the continent. That action is very significant because it makes Kiswahili the only African language that plays that role at the African Union level. Now, there is no doubt in my mind that there is immense hope in the utility of Kiswahili as the lingua franca of the continent, or even just, and without in fact suggesting that Kiswahili will undermine, other languages, it will sit alongside other African languages, but it will play a very important role in encouraging inter-ethnic communication and international communication across the continent.
Thank you very much, Professor Kimani Njogu, for that insight.
Last year in South Africa, Swahili was approved as an optional language for the country's schools. South Africa was the first Southern African country to offer Swahili as an optional subject in schools, raising hopes for the growth of this language all across Africa. A South African teacher here elaborates on the importance of the adoption of Swahili language in her country.
We do welcome the introduction of Swahili because we believe that it is going to promote unity and will promote intercontinental trade and exchanges within the continent.
More African countries are starting to teach Swahili language. What is motivating these countries to teach this East African language?
Its acceptability level is very, very high because, unlike many other languages, it's not ethnically bound in a strong way. So there is no strong ethnic identity associated with the Swahili language. And therefore, its acceptability is higher than, say, any of the other languages that we have, so that a Wolof speaker would be able to speak and learn Swahili without feeling that they are learning a very, very foreign language. In any case, it is situated on the continent. Its rhythm and spirit is the spirit and rhythm of the continent of Africa.
A glance at leading industrial countries across the world clearly shows that all school-going kids in these countries receive their elementary instruction in their first language. This includes countries in North America, Europe, and also Japan, China, South Korea, and Russia.
Now, a Nigerian teacher who has been teaching mathematics in a local language explains here on the advantages of using indigenous languages in a class.
One of the major popular research was done in the Yoruba land, where we had some students who were, for example, who were taught a subject using Yoruba language. So they had two groups of students. One group was taught a particular subject using Yoruba language, while another group was taught English language, and then taught the subject in English. When the result was looked at the end of the day, the highest success rate was recorded from the students who were taught using the Yoruba language. And that's because we can never rule out the power the mother tongue has with regard to learning.
While some indigenous languages in Africa are threatened with extinction, but as we have seen, the tide is turning as more and more young people are learning the languages. Yet to remain relevant, these indigenous languages need to embrace technology.
Now finally, my last question to you, Professor Kimani Njogu. Now what needs to be done to make indigenous African languages appear cool and attractive to the tech-savvy generation?
And African languages are adaptive to really the changing environment. They are never static. They are responsive to the changes that that we experience every day. So, for example, with the entry of mobile phones, African languages are at play in that technology, and they are utilized pretty well in really articulating the technologies. The other area of work really is to link the techies with language workers. Those of us who work with language every day ought to be able to work closely with innovators, with technologists, to be able to come up with terms that best serve, you know, the needs of the techies.
Well, thank you very much, Professor Kimani Njogu, a member of the Kiswahili Cross-Border Language Commission at the African Academy of Languages. Now, unfortunately, our time is up for today. It's an interesting topic, and for sure, we shall revisit this subject in future and maybe even speak in a common African language. And on that note, we come to the end of this week's edition of Africa Today. I'm sure you enjoyed the show, so let's know what you think by dropping us a line through our social media handle. And until our next episode, it's goodbye for now.
You heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
This man changed the world.
Our bosses couldn't cope with the idea of an 80-year-old Ayatollah, which they didn't even know what an Ayatollah was, who lived on garlic and onions and yogurt, directing a revolution that was about to topple America's most important ally.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim, in the name of Allah, the Exalted, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful. Salam, hello and welcome to our audience, and particularly a warm welcome to our program, The Man Who Changed the World. Of course, this program is dedicated to the memory of Imam Khomeini, may God bless his great soul, and it's about his life and times and his great personality. I'm your host for this program, Ijaz Hussain, and I'd first like to welcome my guest who on the program who is going to discuss this great personality with me. And that's Dr. Mahdi Turabi, my good friend, and I'd like to say salam to him and welcome him to the program.
Alaykum salam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. He's an Islamic scholar as well as an academic and a researcher as well. I think we're going to begin from, you know, our continuation, because this is like part two of what we were saying in our previous program, which was about the Bakhtiar government and about the fact that Imam Khomeini, may God bless his great soul, was like a lion. Right, in terms of you know, you talked about the offer that was given by the American government at the time.
Threat and offer.
And, you know, Imam Khomeini, may God bless his great soul, comes out with the fatwa for a jihad against the U.S., which was something that, you know, they hadn't come across. They were completely...
No, it was, bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, basically, and this goes back to, you know, we mentioned in the previous program that Supreme Leader recently was talking about Imam.
Sure.
And we had the quote. I don't know if you want, maybe we can.
Yeah, let's have that quote again. If we could have that quote, please, from the Supreme Leader, and then we'll carry on with our discussion.
کسی مثل امام بزرگوار ما که یک تنه وارد شد.
Somebody like our magnanimous Imam, who single-handedly entered the arena, managed to unite all the people and launch this great movement with his firm determination, faith, and reliance on God, relied more than anything else on knowledge and understanding, on worship of God, and on the enthusiasm which originates from one's heart and soul. Until the end of his life, this great person used to wake up in the middle of the night and shed tears despite being old and physically weak.
با وجود پیری و ناتوانی و شکستگی نیمه شب بر میخواست اشک میریخت. ما خبر داشتیم از نزدیکان ایشان که به همه خصوصیات زندگی
We knew it because we had heard from his close relatives, who knew everything about his lifestyle, that he used to wake up in the middle of the night and ask Allah, the Exalted, for help. He used to keep a vigil at night. He was like this at night, and during the day, he used to enter the arena like a roaring lion and defeat global powers and solve the people's problems. He used to strengthen and set in motion the determination of all the people thanks to his reliance on spirituality.
میکرد اراده های همه ما مردم رو تقویت میکرد و راه میانداخت به برکت اون پشتوانه معنوی.
Yes, I mean, as I say, it's a very, very powerful speech there by the Supreme Leader about Imam Khomeini. But carry on with your point.
So
from the last
we talked about the fact that, you know, at the time you basically had the Shah left.
That's right.
And he had appointed a government led by Shapur Bakhtiar as the government. Imam from the beginning refused to acknowledge the legality of this government, which, you know, we're talking about the fact that Imam was a person who combined spirituality but also was very courageous and also led people.
Yes.
And this being something very new, or he revived this divine tradition, this prophetic tradition.
Prophetic tradition.
Which had been lost, you know, with
over
the
separation. Over the centuries, yes, unfortunately. Yes.
And having to do with the weaknesses of Christianity itself.
Yes.
This is why it was abandoned in Western civilization, because Christianity itself was, you know, changed in such a way that it no longer
became relevant.
Exactly. Mm. So at that time, they said to Imam, I'm just quickly repeating what we spoke about in the previous program and then continuing our analysis of this. They said to Imam at that time, well, you got what you wanted. The Shah has left, you know.
Yeah.
Just, you know, it's done.
That's right.
Good job.
And good job. Go
Thank
back
you.
To the mosque.
Okay. Right. And so basically, they sent a message to him through one of these people that was connected to both sides, saying that, you know, if you don't accept the Bakhtiar government, we will tell the Americans.
The Americans sent this message to Imam.
Yes,
the Strofer,
that if you don't accept the Bakhtiar government, we will tell the army, which at that time the Americans had influence on because a lot of the officers were American trained.
Sure.
We will tell the army to conduct a coup d'etat and arrest all of you and execute all. So what would be the usual response? Because remember, we quoted Henry Kissinger saying that Imam would make decisions that were, you know, earth-shaking. We didn't know how to deal with it. We didn't know what to do. He would do things that were completely different than everybody else. And again, Henry Kissinger saying that, you know, this was because his view was based on divine teachings, on divine teachings and precepts, and thus we didn't know what to do with all this. And, you know, you talked about the fact that, you know, other administration members at that time, U.S. administration, said that, you know, when in the meetings of the experts,
yes, Secretary of State George Shultz
would
yes.
come up with, you know, what should we do about the Ayatollah Khomeini, and everybody would just look at each other, you know, we don't know what
yeah,
to
do. Yeah, well, Shultz being of a German descent anyway, you know, and that's saying something.
Well, Henry is German.
Well, he is German.
Right, exactly.
Sorry.
Right. So
I stand corrected.
Right.
Yeah.
So the point is that Imam, in response to this threat by the Americans, says, if you do this, I will. He didn't issue the fatwa of
no.
jihad. He said, I will issue a fatwa of jihad, and we will fight and take over the country ourselves. So, you know, remember, this is in the context where the Americans, where Mr. Kissinger himself recently had overthrown Allende in Chile. And
yes,
you
yes.
know,
oh yes.
What's the guy's name? Pinochet.
Pinochet in Chile.
And killed all the opposition. You had the same thing happening, Suharto in Indonesia, killing 500,000
yes.
Communist Party members,
yes.
you know, in Indonesia, or, you know, people related to it.
Sure.
You had this happening around the world by the Americans. What I mean with this happening is the military connected to the U.S.
Mm.
conducting coup d'etats and killing the opposition Absolutely. To the Americans in the country.
Sure.
Okay, so this was not some empty
yeah,
threat.
There was not an empty threat.
This
no.
was not something, you know, people had seen this.
Well, I mean, I was going to also say that, you know, we're talking about the aftermath of even the Vietnam War, because even the Vietnam War was fairly recent up until the time of the
right.
Islamic Revolution. So let's not forget that there was a hell of a lot of war crimes and barbarity shown in Vietnam. And, you know, the B-52 bomber with all that, you know, those famous photographs that we see in Apocalypse Now, you know, they show the bombs all coming down, raining bombs all over Vietnam. So you're right, you know, it's not on the back of an empty threat. This is real. I mean, this is something
and
that
a lesser
they could have devastated
and
Iran.
A lesser man would have folded.
A lesser
so
man
the,
would
this
have folded.
This is the point. Okay, this person who was the connection, which
sure.
we mentioned in the previous program, he
yeah.
was a member of the religious national movement in Iran, who had lived in the States for many years, has spent his exile time in the States. He told the story on the BBC. We are quoting his story as he has explained
yes,
in the
absolutely.
So nobody
yeah.
thinks that we're making up stories.
No,
here,
we're not making
right?
up stuff. This is all archived.
Right. So he when he's telling this story on the BBC, you could tell he didn't understand. He was frustrated. He was like, why would Imam like tell them this? Why didn't he just accept it and go to Qom and you know? And this is a religious person.
Yes.
Remember, this is not somebody, you know, who's, you know,
there are religious people in inverted commas and religious
right.
people.
So the point is, as you said, it's, you know, you having this deep belief, it's
deep
not only
belief.
About reading the Quran, it's not only about,
no,
you know, it's about
because you
belief.
Mentioned this word faith, didn't you? You
right.
mentioned
it's
this
faith. It's
you.
Not just knowing things. You have to believe in it.
Yeah,
when the Quran says that you can stand up to the biggest oppressors and be successful,
sure.
well, you have to believe it.
You have
it's,
to believe
you know,
it.
It's good to read it. It's good to say, well, you know, give it... You're doing a speech, you're doing a radio program, blah, 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 you know, yeah, and the Quran says, but you don't really believe it in your life, you know, if you don't translate that in your life, you know, what's
the
point? So this is the beauty of Imam, is that he had complete trust in Allah, had complete trust in the word of Allah.
Yeah, we could see that. We could see
and
that.
He lived it. And when he was challenged and when he was tested by Allah and when Shaitan tried to, you know, threaten him with... what is it with poverty and corruption?
Kinds of things, corruption
right? He
was, yeah.
stood up and he, you know, said, "This is the deal."
Yeah.
So, this is the first part. As
well, first part. That's right. That's
so then he comes to Iran.
Mm.
Bakhtiar government is still there.
Still there.
He
yes,
enters the famous film of him coming with the plane.
Cemetery, yes.
And he goes directly from the airport.
Yeah.
He goes to Besht Sahara, which
throughout
is
the adulation of. You know, millions welcoming him at Mehrabad.
Right.
Airport,
and
yeah.
throughout the way on the road, as we've seen in the films,
sure.
he goes straight to Besht Sahara, which is the main cemetery in
These
Tehran.
These are big iconic images, yes.
Right. And he goes to the area where many of the Shuhada of the revolution and
sorry,
the fight against
yes, at Behesht Yazara, yes.
Against the regime of the Shah are
right.
buried, and he holds a speech there.
That's correct, yes.
And here, remember, this is with the threat that he's gotten.
Yes, already.
Okay, there's rumors and everybody's scared that, you know, they're going to shoot down his plane.
Mm-hmm.
And they say to him, well, what if... he goes, takes a nap during the flight.
Yes, he does.
You know, they're like, everybody's like on tender
yeah,
hooks.
Yeah,
like,
they're all sort of like...
you know,
yeah,
we're going to get shut down.
A SAM battery opening
right,
up any moment.
Right,
yeah.
And he goes and takes a nap, okay? Because
yes.
he gets off the plane, you know, you have this in this typical Eastern, you know, emotionalism saying, oh, what do you feel...
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
right,
about entering, he goes...
John Simpson asked him that.
Yeah, he goes, nothing. No, no, it was an Iranian.
Was it?
It was also an Iranian. He says, what do you feel? And he says the famous
Heech,
nothing. What do you feel? Nothing. And they misunderstood. When he meant Heech, it meant that, you know, this